ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When was the last time you really looked at your kettle, your umbrella, the hallway mirror, or even a gravestone? Every one of them was designed by someone for a reason. And those choices are still shaping how you live. The ordinary isn't ordinary at all. That's By Design with me, Anthony Burke. Find it on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, it's rather dangerous these days to be an opposition leader who wants to play by the rules in Turkey.
Because you just cannot avoid the overweening ambitions of one President Recep Erdogan.
He believes in a whatever-it-takes approach to power.
And Turks are transfixed yet again by an epic struggle for the soul of their country.
And whether the president's firming up his plans to embed autocratic rule. I'm Geraldine Doogue.
And I'm Latika Burke. Welcome to Global Roaming.
Yes, I have to say, I know this is not necessarily true of a lot of Australians, Latika, but I never take my eyes off Turkey because I think it's a very romantic place. And I mean, I've been to Gallipoli and done a presentation there, you know, and that you read and read and listen. And President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, you know, the sort of poor boy turned soccer player, turned mayor of Istanbul, turned PM, turned president. He's just this huge character there before Trump was really on the global stage.
Yes, it is a transfixing country and the center of so many geopolitical battles, I suppose, taking shape right before us. And the world's eyes are going to be transfixed on Turkey for two big reasons later this year. Geraldine, in July, it's the NATO summit, and that will be quite a critical summit because it's the big verification of whether NATO allies are stepping up and meeting their defence spending commitments. So there'll be a lot of focus on this because, of course, President Trump's not going to be happy with the inevitable outcome, which is too many aren't. And then later in the year, Geraldine, remember Australia wanting to host COP?
Yes, I do remember.
And then Turkey came in and said, no, we'd rather like it. Now we've got this extremely bizarre situation of a split COP where Australia is the president, but Turkey really is the big host. Well, there's going to be a lot of world leaders descending, brandishing their green credentials. And guess who's going to be basking in that green light, shall we say? I dare say President Erdogan.
Indeed. While he busily last week essentially quite violently removed the head of the oldest party in Turkey, the CHP, Özgür Özel, from his office, sort of tore him out of his office. He is at the moment in detention, as is the former mayor of Istanbul, who was a quite charismatic character, İmamoğlu, all basically out of the picture in terms of being able to challenge Erdogan. And it's amazing to me that this hasn't had more coverage because it was a really, and there's enormous protests and so on in Turkey. It's a place that a lot of Australians travel to, but it sort of slips under the radar, doesn't it?
But do you know, I wonder if something deep is going on here, Geraldine. I wonder if it's just become so difficult to keep up with all the democratic backsliding, to keep up with all the illiberalism, to actually know how to even say to somebody you're breaking the rules in your own country when so many others are doing it. I think it's become a challenge that is just too great. And when a country like Turkey is so central to things like Russia, Ukraine, things like NATO is fending off missile attacks from Iran, I just wonder if people say, I've only got so much bandwidth and Turkey is not high on that list.
Well, look, we're going to find out some of these contradictions that is just part and parcel of looking at Turkey with a longtime resident of Istanbul, the author Susie Hansen, about this really major power struggle inside Turkey under Erdogan. Her latest book is From Life Itself, Turkey, Istanbul and Neighbourhood in the Age of Erdogan. It charts all these developments from one particular part of a place she has spent so much of her life. Here she is now.
Thank you for having me.
Look, you've lived in Istanbul a long time and you've no doubt watching these massive protests carefully, yet again these massive protests following the removal of the opposition leader. Is this particular level of resistance that you're seeing against President Erdogan surprising you or not?
No, because this was a very big event. I mean, I think if you're listening, you're noticing that a lot of Turkey experts are talking about this as a major turning point in Turkey's evolution from a democratic country to an autocratic one. Many people believe that this is the end of competitive authoritarianism, which was a phase that Turkey was in for quite some time. I mean, people have been more pessimistic than that on and off over the years. But this is the removal of the elected opposition leader, the main opposition leader, and many people see this as a point of no return. It's not something that has happened before. Now, of course, they did already put Ekrem İmamoğlu in jail, who was a prospective presidential candidate from the opposition party. But this suggests that they want to install their own weak leader into the opposition party so they can control it.
Yes, I have seen one particular line that Erdogan is actually devising his own opposition now. It's some sort of fig leaf.
Yes, and that draws comparisons to Russia. I think that it is increasingly resembling Russia. I always try to stay away from suggesting that all of the strong men are the same, that they all resemble each other. And Turkey and Russia's history is very different, especially its recent history. It wasn't as repressive a country. It had a different kind of democracy for longer than Russia has had. However, we are entering into a new phase where this is the oldest party in Turkey. This is the founding party of the state.
Of the opposition, you mean, the opposition party.
Yes, and so it's a different kind of emotional and psychological blow for everybody.
And Susie, what's the pretext for the arrest and is it going to work?
There have been allegations of corruption against this party, and I just want to say very clearly, because I've even seen places like the New York Times have these headlines that say corruption or politics, which is it? And I want to make sure everyone knows that if a leader has been, an autocratic leader has been in power for 20 years and he starts saying that his opposition is corrupt, you can bet that that's a lie. The pretext for exactly deposing this leader of the opposition party was, you know, they were suggesting there were election irregularities of the leader, and then there was a court ruling that annulled the election. But it's all smoke and mirrors. I mean, none of this is really based in reality.
And why now, Susie? Do you think that Erdogan is looking around and seeing maybe some other illiberal leaders being shown the door by proper democratic processes, maybe, say, for example, in Hungary? What's making him nervous right now?
I actually would point to domestic politics there and recent elections or you know, semi-recent elections. In 2023, Erdogan won the presidential election again. Many people thought that the Turks still had a chance of unseating him. And it was a very exciting election. I was there. But he won again. In 2024, there were local elections, municipal elections. And AKP lost across the country to exactly this party, the CHP. So people took out their anger at the AKP for this terrible economy that they have and many other illiberal abuses by voting against AKP in these local elections. And I think that scared him very much. And he began to look at someone like the mayor of Istanbul, Ekrem İmamoğlu, who was incredibly popular and had done a really good job managing the city, and saying, I cannot tolerate this kind of competition. And I will say also, İmamoğlu resembled Erdogan in some ways, you know, not in terms of their politics and not in terms of their lifestyle, but he was someone who was a bit tougher. He was from the Black Sea. He was a businessman. He went to mosque on Fridays. You know, I mean, he was able to be appealing to a wider number of people in Turkey, which the previous CHP CHP leaders had not been able to do.
And he is still in prison, isn't he?
He is still in prison, along with a number of other figures.
Mm-hmm. What's the involvement of the courts in all of this brew that you're describing?
I mean, I think that's something that's very difficult to understand from afar. There's whether or not Erdogan controls the courts is a fuzzy question. You have courts that will still continue to work, and you have courts that will not work. I think in these kind of gradualist authoritarian regimes, you have a mix of functions of the judiciary. But for the most part, he began firing judges and replacing them with lackeys starting in 2013, 14, 15, and certainly with the 2016 military coup. It's an atmosphere of intimidation and a knowledge that the political will at the top wants a certain outcome, which is always going to affect some of these some of these judgments.
Is there any prospect of their release?
I think that, again, and I think that if I sound ambivalent about this, it's because Turks themselves always are bracing for surprises. I mean, I think that in recent years, especially, many things have happened that nobody expected, like that 2016 military coup. And so there was some talk for a while that, yes, maybe he would let İmamoğlu out, but he would prevent him from ever running again. I mean, he also has, I mean, he sort of has international opinion to consider, or the business, you know, the larger environment for his economy, although I think Western leaders have barely been criticizing Erdogan ever since they began to believe they needed him in the region, or as after he was really asserting himself on the world stage. And so that has been really terrible for Turkish democracy. And I hope that it changes now. I'm a bit pessimistic about that.
Actually, that was precisely my question, is why hasn't there been more overt fuss over this opposition leader being dragged out of his office? And somebody, the installation or the sort of, I don't know even how you describe what Erdogan is trying to do with the other man. Can you say his name? Because I find it very difficult to pronounce, please.
Of course, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. He's the man who ran against Erdogan in 2023. And he lost to him, and he has lost many times in the past. He has not led the CHP to victory for many years since Erdogan took over in 2002, 2003.
He's rather dull, I read.
Dull, but he's also, you know, more of a... He was known as the Turkish Gandhi, which was, I thought, a slightly ridiculous label. But I think what it implies is that he had a kind of gentler aspect to him. He's also a Alevi, which means he's from a minority community, which really means a lot in Turkey, which is dominated by the Sunni Muslim sect. And so all of these things come into play, but he's very important for Alevis, who make up 20 to 25% of the population, which is a significant population. So lots of complexity there. But why not the outcry? I mean, I would ask the same question. What I would say is this dates back a while ago. It dates back to 2016, when Erdogan struck a deal with the European Union about the Syrian refugees, in which, you know, he was threatening Europe all the time. I'm going to just allow all of these Syrian Arabs into Europe if you keep criticizing me or threatening me. And that scared them, of course, because everybody was trying to prevent Syrian refugees from coming into their country at that point. They were also giving him billions of dollars to keep them or supposedly support them on their shores. And so there begins this bargaining chip that he has that he can play at any time. And then also you've noticed over the years, he's asserted himself as this important geopolitical player. And in some ways he is, but in some ways now it's become even more intense because of Russia and the threat that Europe feels from the Russians and their advances. I mean, they're not doing as well now, but for a while they were doing well in Ukraine. Obviously, Europe is feeling more fearful of the Russians, and Turkey's in the middle. And so, you know, you have people flattering him quite a lot, actually. What an important leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan is. So it's been the opposite of criticism for quite some time. And then now we have Trump, who seems to love him.
Susie, a couple of weeks ago, I was in Yerevan, Armenia, and a Turkish diplomat there said to me, well, did you see Ursula von der Leyen, the EU Commission president, lump Turkey in the same basket as China and Russia recently?
Oh, that's right.
This went down like a lead balloon in Turkey. They are very sensitive about the criticism when it does come, even if it's rare. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that also struck me as a bit of overreach. I wouldn't lump him. I don't even know what that means, saying that he's similar to China, to be quite honest with you, or what they're asserting in terms of his. But also, I mean, it's Turkey. It's not China. China is an enormous country that you know, can throw around a lot of weight all over the world. Turkey doesn't have quite that amount of power. It's a regional power, no matter what Erdogan says. I mean, Turks are very sensitive to Western criticism. They always have been, both from the Americans or the Europeans. And Erdogan has really preyed on that sensitivity. And part of what drove his popularity for a very long time was that he was able to give the impression that he was standing up to them. He might have still been maintaining relations behind the scenes or doing business and trade with them just as much as before, but the rhetoric would often mean something, because that woundedness, as you can understand, Turkey has been treated in a condescending way by the Europeans for some time. So it's not as if it's completely out of bounds. But the way that Erdogan manipulates it and manipulates his people with that rhetoric is a sight to behold.
We're talking to the author Susie Hansen about the rise of authoritarianism in Turkey under President Erdogan. Her latest book is From Life Itself, Turkey, Istanbul and Neighbourhood in the Age of Erdogan, and it tracks the demise of democracy in Turkey. Turkey does have the second largest army on the continent. It's got a Black Sea coastline. It really does matter in geopolitics. It's the only NATO country that hasn't approved sanctions against Russia. People like Mark Rutte, the head of NATO, has clearly been buttering him up. And in fact, the sort of difference between him and Ursula von der Leyen is very interesting, sort of highlighting this real... There's a tremendous dilemma, as I read, inside Europe as to how you deal with Erdogan, who you never know where Erdogan's foreign policy really is. It sort of moves around. Where is he now? Where does he place himself?
So, yes, of course, Turkey is still very important. They are part of NATO. I was going to mention that about Mark Rutte. And then that is, of course, why, you know, the Americans have always privileged that relationship. Over the course of its existence, its military has been built with the infrastructure of NATO and with that defensive sphere. So, of course, it's very important. As I have often said in my writing, you know, the geography is too big to fail, you know, whether it is. But I think that Erdogan overstates his ability to influence events. Foreign leaders don't really know what to make of him or what he might do. And so that also reflects why foreign leaders don't really know what to make of him or what he might do, because he just always adjusts. You know, he can be going in one direction, you know, making peace with the Kurds one day and then turning against them the next. And he manages to stay in power while doing that footwork. I think it makes it very difficult for foreign leaders to deal with him, yes.
There's going to be a lot of red carpet in Turkey this year. We've got the NATO summit coming up. Then we've also got COP. Is there any reason why Turkey wanted to host COP? Is it part of this exercise to brandish this image worldwide?
I have to say, I'm not entirely sure about that. But yes, I mean, it is always, as you notice, he's always talking about being the middleman for Ukraine and Russia. Or yes, I have Hamas, you know, Hamas is living here. We can have these talks in Turkey. I mean, it's something that fills them with a certain amount of pride, but also in its geographic location, it does make a certain amount of sense. And I think it does suggest, though, doesn't it, that it's sort of Eastern-Western position is still important to Turkey. You know, they haven't jettisoned the Western one. But I think most importantly to the psychology of the leaders and to some degree, the long-term psychology of the people, it's as with all countries, they want to be seen as independent and they want to be seen as strong and they want to be able to see as directing their own fate and being players at the table. And I think that that is something that Erdogan always promised his people. And I think that promise is starting to fail.
And Susie, would any of those moves, would they trigger a backlash?
So this is really the interesting question. And I think we have this about many countries these days, including the one I'm living in, which is the United States, is where are the protests? Where I think that this is causing a massive backlash in Turkey. You know, you have to factor in that people protested the İmamoğlu imprisonment. And those were enormous protests. Those of us in the West aren't seeing that much news about Turkey, unfortunately. But those were enormous protests. People reacted. But they're afraid also. I mean, he has scared people. And people are also incredibly beaten down. I was just in Turkey in March, incredibly beaten down by this economy. It is destroying people's lives. It's destroying young people's futures. Many of them just want to leave. You know, there's a pessimism that takes hold. But I do wonder if this latest move, you know, against a kind of sacred party in the country is enlivening people once again. But what can they do? You know, I think that's unclear right now.
We were warned that it was difficult to get people to talk because they were becoming more afraid, which was interesting because, you know, for many years I've been interviewing people in Turkey and there are lots of commentators ready to chat. So maybe something is shifting. Also, the birth rate is dropping off a cliff. And in fact, one of the interesting byproducts of Erdogan's reign is that he's called birth control betrayal. He's made it a very personal thing, call for much bigger families and so on. So I wonder how you sense young people, given that you have written from, you know, you've looked at one neighbourhood and tried to look at a very complex neighbourhood and to see how it is taking these amazing changes. How do you read the various moods underway? Do you think there is some sort of shift coming out of that pessimism?
Absolutely. I mean, in the beginning, when he took power in the 2000s, there was a narrative that he was employing and that was working really well for him, which was that religious people were oppressed, that they did not have their full rights, that women couldn't go to university with a headscarf on at public universities. I mean, many things like that. And that the religious people of the country had been looked down upon, kept out of the economic sphere of the country or had a sort of ceiling on how far they could rise. And that there was just a tremendous amount of discrimination and snobbery against them. And so Erdogan was the one who came along and enfranchised them and elevated them and allowed them to live and dress and do what they wanted to do. And I think there were young people who were very caught up or inspired by that message. And they themselves might have started wearing a headscarf, but also wearing, you know, sparkly tights or whatever. I mean, it's not, you know, Turkey had a very interesting hybrid way of dealing with religiosity and modernity. But a lot of those people did achieve those new heights and they did achieve or attain more freedoms. And that story is over now because the economy is no longer good. They don't need to fight for those rights anymore. They themselves have shared for 20 years in a certain amount of power. And all they're seeing is that their great economy is now being destroyed, that their media has been completely taken over and they have no information sources. And this feeling of, as some characters in my book anyway, these young women in my book who grew up with parents who loved Erdogan, they just said it's just they stayed too long. And I think that that's how most people feel. This was not the direction that they thought the country was going to go in. It's very heartbreaking. Heartbreak. Yeah, a lot of it.
And Susie, what about across the country? Do we see a divide between the cities and the regions?
I think that the regional, like the other cities in the country are also experiencing the same anger at the AKP. That was those were the municipal and local elections that I was talking about. And that was new because for a long time, when you looked at an electoral map of Turkey, you saw it was CHP on the coastlines only, and then, you know, AKP everywhere else, although it usually won Istanbul until 2019 and usually won Ankara. But you would see that AKP kind of covered the whole society. Another question is, you know, there was this terrible earthquake in 2023, and there was immediately the presidential election after that. He was widely seen as having been responsible for why a lot of these buildings collapsed immediately as soon as the earthquake struck. And then I don't think the rebuilding or...
Because of poor building standards.
Because of poor building standards and also the changes he made to the laws or the changes he didn't make to the laws. But it was also, they failed to get to people quickly enough. But the presidential election was right after that. And a lot of people just thought, well, what are we going to do? Elect a whole new president and another party? I mean, you know, a lot of people in that region just felt it was better to continue with the party we know. But what about now? I think you could see, you know, the backlash can come later.
Susie, from everything you're describing, it doesn't sound like Turkey is a country with ambitions to join the European Union anytime soon anymore.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think that my sense from most people in the country was that they just simply didn't think it was ever going to happen. It's so interesting to think about now because Erdogan came to power in part because he was, and his government was, going through with a lot of the EU reforms that the EU was demanding for it to accede that made people believe in him. And he did make a lot of those changes. And when 2008-09 rolled around and Nicolas Sarkozy was derogatory towards Turkey and certainly gave the impression that they wanted nothing to do with 80 million Muslims coming into Europe, this was again the beginning of that time when Erdogan could say, you know what, we don't need you either. You guys are mired in a global financial crisis. We don't want anything to do with you. And again, could capitalize on that with his rhetoric and his politics. And I think that was the beginning of a shift as well. I mean, obviously, the EU would not allow Turkey into the European Union now. Unless he was bribing them. Unless he was bribing them with something or blackmailing them with something, you never know.
Susie, that's been a marvelous overview. Thank you so much for joining us.
Very nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you.
Bye-bye.
Well, Latika, as somebody who is quite fascinated by Turkey, I found that a really terrific overview, a sort of mix of the sociological plus the broader strategic areas. I'd love to know whether the Orban, that the efforts to defeat Orban, you know, the Peter Magyar efforts, would work in Turkey. That whole idea of getting right through into the people of the country and just going back and back and back, which is what they did, and it's sort of admirable. Electoral behaviour by the opposition to win might work in Turkey.
I agree with you. As Susie was talking, I realised how much we've been missing from this very complex story about Turkey's position. And it is true, they're absolutely vital to NATO. I mean, they've been a very capable NATO partner, Geraldine, shooting down missiles coming at them from Iran during this war. You know, NATO, Turkey has been a very capable actor. Remember, they shut down a Russian jet as well. I mean, they've certainly had their disputes with everybody and come out stronger for it. So they do play a very important role. Geraldine, what I also found fascinating from that discussion was how actually it was the path towards Europe that gave him his initial strength. And then it turns sour. And that is a very similar story to Hungary, by the way. I was talking to an advisor last week in Prague who was working for Orban. And I said, when did you think it was going bad? She said, it was good for a long time, actually. But when it went bad, it did. It was really noticeable and there was a clean break from the good and the bad. You know, these authoritarians don't start out the way they end.
Yeah, no, quite. I agree, because that is just interesting that 2016, when they had that, there was a failed coup that actually done, we still don't exactly know who was behind all of that coup. And Erdogan, quotes, won. And, you know, that was really an extraordinarily important moment in bedding him down. It was the same year as the Brexit referendum. So, you know, it's quite interesting, these years when huge things happen and 10 years on, you're dealing with the aftermath. I must say, I do think that, you know, it doesn't get the attention I think it deserves.
Yeah.
And just a reminder of our guest today, Susie Hansen, H-A-N-S-E-N, with her book From Life Itself, Turkey, Istanbul and Neighbourhood in the Age of Erdogan, charting all that we were talking about today. And you might like to seek that out. Well, look, I think we might leave it there. We've got some terrific feedback about AUKUS in particular, Latika. And in fact, I think Hamish and I are going to try to talk about AUKUS later this week, so we'll have plenty of time to air that. That leaves me with an invitation to all of you to write to us with your feedback, and we honestly do read it and allow it to affect us, global.roaming@abc.net.au. Where are you off to next, Latika? Are you back in London soon?
I'm going home. You will love this. I'm going home for an hour to drop my bag off, and then I'm heading to Stockholm to do... You're laughing, Geraldine. To do a roundtable...
I am laughing.
...a roundtable with the German Marshall Fund on behalf of the ANU Security College, where I wear another hat, on China with the Swedish government. I'm really looking forward to this.
Oh, very interesting. As we said, as you said, you know, often the Europeans clear the room when you start talking about China. So this is designed to draw people's attention and to skill themselves up a bit more, by the sound of it.
Yes. And I think the Swedes are taking it very seriously.
Latika, enjoy your travels. We'll see you next time.
See you, Geraldine.
Bye-bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.